This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
So much going on. We mentioned New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy considering cash incentives to get people vaccinated. Meantime, Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihiro Suga extending a state of emergency that covers Tokyo. I do wonder what will happen ultimately, Tim, with the Olympics. Right now, global cases, 156.1 million, deaths exceeding 3.25 million.
Yeah, it's a different story inside the United States where vaccinations continue to be administered, though they are down from their peak significantly. Let's get all into all that and more with Dr. Harold Paz, CEO at Wexner Medical Center, also Chancellor of Health Affairs at The Ohio State University. He joins us on the phone from Columbus, Ohio. Dr. Paz, thanks so much for coming back on the show. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, let's get right into it and talk specifically about incentives that are being set up here in the United States or thought about in the United States to get people to that 70% or even 85% of American adults vaccinated. Governor Phil Murphy, the governor of New Jersey, said that everything is on the table, including beer, savings bonds, free baseball game tickets, and even cash. Is this the right way to get people who are hesitant about vaccines vaccinated?
I think anything we can do to get an individual vaccinated is incredibly important because in as much as we want to achieve herd immunity, we know that an individual that's vaccinated is going to be protected to the greatest degree possible from becoming infected with COVID. And we've seen from other parts of the world what can happen very, very quickly, particularly because of these variants, these mutated forms of the virus, and what it can do in countries like India. And you just mentioned a few minutes ago the concerns in Japan. So the more individuals we can vaccinate, that's another individual that hopefully the vaccine will prevent them from becoming seriously ill and even worse, being hospitalized or dying. That's number one. Number two, vaccinated individuals are going to be less likely to spread the disease to somebody else. And number three, there are just so many more things that they will be able to do as part of activities of daily living. The CDC just came out with this infogram that shows what they recommend a vaccinated person can do versus someone that's not vaccinated in terms of socially being active, being with family and friends, dining, all these things that are so important to us. Mm-hmm. It's a simple process, showing up and getting a vaccine once or twice, depending on which one you get.
Dr. Paz, I'm going to tell you, though, like Tim and I have had conversations with intelligent people who are concerned about getting the vaccine for numerous reasons, or who will say, yeah, ultimately I'm going to get it, but I'm just not going to get it yet. And so what would you say to these individuals? I mean, Tim and I feel lucky. We have a conversation with somebody very smart from the medical community every day, a doctor like yourself. What do you say to individuals who are nervous about the vaccine?
I would say that in my mind, there has never been a rollout of a new treatment or a drug or a vaccination that has been under this scrutiny, level of scrutiny, as these vaccines. And the degree in which they're being watched is unprecedented. And the best example I can give is the concern that caused the pause in the J&J vaccine. There were some cases that were identified of women. We're all very familiar with those reports. And that caused the FDA and the CDC to pause the J&J vaccine until there was more information to better understand what was going on. That should give all of us assurance that this is being carefully monitored. And when you weigh the risk-benefit, and this is really the crux of the matter, the risk-benefit of getting COVID-19 and winding up in the hospital, winding up on a ventilator, and even potentially dying, or the risk of getting vaccinated, for me as a physician and as I advise patients, family, and friends, that decision is very, very clear. Mm. And I've been vaccinated. My family, my entire family's been vaccinated. It, to me, is a very simple decision. And I've urged everyone, unless there is some real medical reason, and there are some very rare cases like that where they can't get vaccinated, I've advised everyone to get vaccinated because nobody wants to get a serious case of this virus and this illness. And we're seeing what's going on right now in India. And, you know, part of that is the thinking was they made it through the first several surges. And now look what's going on in that country. And the question is, why is that happening? These are individuals that may have, we don't have all the data yet. It's possible they had the infection on the first go around, mild cases of infection. It's a younger population. They don't have the kind of obesity that other parts of the world. They may have had mild or asymptomatic cases, but now this variant is coming back through the country. And you look at the number of infected individuals that have been identified. There may be others that haven't been identified. And you look at the number of individuals and just the photographs in the film on TV, and you see what's going on there. What better example can we think of, as tragic as that is, for every American to go out and get vaccinated?
Dr. Paz, we only have about 40 seconds left, and then we're going to come back with you. But I'm wondering about messaging when it comes to benefits of the vaccine, because it does seem like there's been a real missed opportunity with people continuing to wear masks outside, even though we know with the science and with being vaccinated, among other things, it's not you don't necessarily need to be that cautious. We only have about 20 seconds here.
So yes, if you're vaccinated, you no longer need to wear a mask outdoors. You can visit other fully vaccinated people indoors without masks
right.
in small numbers. I mean, that's a huge advantage right there.
Let's get back to Dr. Harold Paz. He's Executive Vice President, Chancellor for Health Affairs at The Ohio State University, CEO of Wexner Medical Center. It's a massive enterprise, hospitals, College of Medicine, research, and more. He was also the former Chief Medical Officer over at Aetna, still with us on the phone from Columbus, Ohio. Dr. Paz, one thing we wanted to ask you, because I know when we talked with you in January, it was just coming off of some news that you guys had discovered a new variant of COVID-19. There's a bunch of variants out there. What do we need to be smart about or understand when it comes to variants? And I would assume that there's more to come.
Yeah, so the virus will continue to mutate, and there will continue to be variants. This variant that is of great concern now is B117, the UK variant. The reason it's of concern is it's much more contagious. And the other concern is some of these variants could become more lethal as well. Oftentimes we see that a virus gets more contagious, it gets less lethal. But if it does both at the same time, that's extremely concerning. So again, that's why we want to get out in front of these variants by vaccinating as many people as we can. If we do that, then we stop the virus from spreading from person to person to person, and we reduce the likelihood of the virus actually mutating. That's the goal here, and that's why the goal was to achieve herd immunity, to prevent that type of an event from occurring.
Dr. Paz, the worst-case scenario could be a variant that emerges that could get past or so-called breakthrough the vaccine. Is there any indication that could happen or is happening now?
Well, what we need to do is to prepare for mutations that are not well covered by the existing vaccines. And that's where the booster vaccine will become important. And I think we should all be prepared for a world where we do get periodic booster vaccines. You know, the interesting thing is that's part of normal life for so many different things. We're all used to getting a flu vaccine every year, and hopefully everybody does do that. We also get booster vaccines for our tetanus vaccine every 5 years. We get booster vaccines if we've been immunized for hepatitis if we need to. We can have shingles. We can have chickenpox as a child, but later in adult life, we get a resurgence of that. We call it shingles. There's a vaccine for that, too. I don't think there's anything, I mean, this is a tragic, tragic set of circumstances, but it is a virus. And with vaccines, we would deal with it the same way we deal with any other virus for which we have a vaccine. So we're going to get used to this frame of mind where periodically we come in and we get a booster, and the booster is designed around the kind of variants that are out there. That's what we do with the flu vaccine every year. We know that the flu has mutations, and we develop a very tailor-made specific vaccine for that year's flu.
When it comes to a booster, is it going to be crucial that we really watch the timing on that? Because I do wonder if, you know, once our immunity goes away from these first two shots that we got, or the first shot if you got a J&J vaccine, does your immunity just go to zero? How does that work?
Yeah. So without getting too technical, there are two types of immunity. There is the antibody immunity, and then there's cellular immunity. That's where we have cells in our body. They're called T cells, for example, that can be part of this response to kill the virus. The issue here is more about a variant that can bypass our current immunity, get around all that. So that's where the booster is important. It may not be that our immunity has waned or has gone away. It may be that our antibodies are not trained for that variant. The booster will create new antibodies and new cellular immunity that will attack the variant virus. That's what we want to be able to do here. And I think, again, for those of us that have already had our first two vaccines, or in the case of Johnson & Johnson, one vaccine, we want to make sure that as soon as these boosters are developed and obviously have approval from either emergency use authorization from the FDA or totally approved by the FDA, that we would go out and get our boosters.
Sounds like my vaccine card is going to continue to get filled.
Yeah, don't laminate it.
Yeah, exactly. Dr. Harold Paas, thank you so much. A great voice and has been over the life of this pandemic. CEO at Wexner Medical Center, Chancellor of Health Affairs at The Ohio State University, with us once again from Columbus, Ohio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, it is time now for today's Bloomberg Big Take. It's the Bloomberg exclusive you need to be focusing on and that only we've got. It also happens to be a story featured in the magazine this week, Tim, and it's about the anti-Asian hate crime capital of North America. Turns out it's Vancouver. I did not know that.
I did not know that until reading this either. Natalie Obiko-Pearson is Vancouver Bureau Chief, and she joins us now on the phone from Vancouver, British Columbia. Natalie, can you take us through the history of people of Asian descent in Vancouver and in Canada?
Sure. And to your point, I think a lot of people in Vancouver aren't aware that they are the hate crime capital
wow,
of
wow.
North America.
Wow.
I mean, this city is very, very multicultural, and it's always thought of itself as this sort of progressive bastion. We have a very long history of Asian immigration starting over a century ago. In fact, the city wouldn't even exist if it weren't for Chinese laborers who built the railway that created this city. But along with that history comes a very deep uneasy one. Those Chinese laborers, two of them died for every mile of that railway that was built. And since then, there have been waves of immigration that have been faced a lot of resistance. Some of Canada's worst excesses against Asian communities all took root here. A ban on Chinese immigration for decades, a head tax on Chinese migrants, and during World War II, 22,000 Japanese who were interned here. So there is a very deep, dark history.
All right. So deep, dark history that has been there for a long time, as you just so eloquently described to us. And yet, in the last year during the pandemic, it really reared its ugly head.
Absolutely. And I think the thing here is, you know, COVID, like many places, was a trigger. But it, in Vancouver particularly, it tapped into tensions that have been building over, I'd say, the last 2 to 3 decades. So the latest chapter of this of Asian, anti-Asian bias partook root about 2 or 3 months, about 3 decades ago, when Hong Kong was going to revert to Chinese rule, and you had a lot of wealthy migrants coming over and putting down roots here. That essentially changed what had previously been perceived as an immigrant underclass into this new elite, sort of this very wealthy elite that changed the face of the city. I think few cities in the world have kind of seen the transformation that Vancouver has from Asian immigration and money. It went from this sort of industrial backwater into this glittering cosmopolis of like shiny new condo towers and luxury boutiques. And that has really fed resentment.
But a point that you make is the numbers just aren't there for who owns what.
That's right. So this, about 2014, we had this very acute run-up in housing prices, and housing affordability has been public issue number one. The narrative that took hold was that Asian buyers, and particularly Chinese buyers, were responsible for driving that run-up, and yet the data was really never there to back that. Even at its peak, it wasn't the kind of numbers that would sway a market where, 42,000 transactions were happening a year. And yet, housing affordability is a really complex issue. Many of the drivers you can't see, interest rates or supply issues. But what took hold was a very easy scapegoat. All these rich Chinese coming in and buying up our houses and sitting in these mansions that stay empty when they go back to China. And so that very much, I think, fed into what we've seen in the past year.
So where's the leadership in all of this, political or otherwise?
I would say that this is really a cautionary tale for that very reason. The leadership in this region during that helped stoke that debate about Asian money inflating housing prices here. They conducted this dirty money probe, a money laundering effort that actually, it made Asian wealth synonymous with illicit wealth. That was one very corrosive thing. And then they also attributed the run-up in housing prices to dirty money coming into the region. And there really, once again, was no data to definitively back that. And so I think they, inadvertently, they might have stoked this debate without meaning to, but I think it does beg the question, you have to look back and see how this narrative came about and the role that policymakers played in it.
Is there any sort of movement happening right now to raise awareness of what's going on there? And I'm only basing this on my experience of being in the United States, when we have seen a dramatic rise in anti-Asian hate crimes here. And mm-hmm. I'll say it again before reading this. I thought the U.S. was unique in this, but it's not. What is the public discourse about this right now?
Well, Canada predictably has been very vociferous in sort of condemning these types of attacks. But I think you do have to, for all of your public statements about, this is not Canadian and this is not what we stand for, you have to ask, how is it that the most liberal corner of Canada ended up becoming the hate crime capital?
Yeah.
And to what role did liberals play a part in feeding this very sort of insidious narrative that stoked anti-Asian bias? So I do think these figures will probably come as a shock to the city today.
How bad has it gotten in terms of you talk about some specific people in your story?
Yeah. It is quite alarming. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm half Asian, and I've experienced this myself firsthand. People accosting me at the beginning of the pandemic, berating me for wearing a face mask and asking which frontline worker I'd stolen it from. And just when the people I've interviewed and other Asian friends that I have here, we talk about how it's, especially when you're sort of walking alone on the street, it makes you think twice.
But some of the people you interviewed and you feature in the story said to you, this is not surprising to me because this is what I've experienced my entire life, and in fact didn't even report the incidents.
Absolutely. And so there, I mean, I wanted to make a distinction. Since the COVID pandemic started, this latest wave has definitely been more virulent. It's been more in your face. But the underlying sentiment has been there for a very long time. So one of the things that Trixie Ling, one of the women that I spoke to who was spat on at the beginning of the pandemic, I think she put it really well. It's surprising, and yet at the same time, it's not surprising for Asians here. They've been very aware of this race, this undercurrent for a long time. It's just the viciousness of it in the last year that has really surprised people.
Well, an enlightening and disturbing story at the same time. Natalie, thank you so much. Bloomberg News, Vancouver Bureau Chief Natalie Obiko-Pearson joining us on the phone from Vancouver, British Columbia.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Oh yeah, our most read story on the Bloomberg in the past 8 hours. It's about job growth. Disappointing. Had to be.
It had to be. I mean, this was, I'll say it again, it was jaw-dropping. The biggest miss in absolute terms on record.
Listen, we were talking about 1 million. We were talking about the possibility of some estimates of 2 million, and then we got 266,000 and a revised downward number for the March increase. So let's get into it, see what she's seeing. Irina Novoselsky is CEO of Career Builder, which for more than 20 years has been helping global companies hire global workers. She's back with us on the phone in New York City. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, Carol. Good to be back.
Well, good to have you here. And listen, we love having folks like you on because we get a number like we got this Friday, Friday morning. Quite shocking, quite disappointing in terms of expectations that it was going to kind of support that the economy is increasingly getting back on track. How do you see it? How does it support what you are seeing and what you do and the companies that you're working with?
Carol, this number is a little bit confusing to what's happening underneath the surface.
Okay.
I'll give you an example. So we have 50% more supply of candidates in the market than pre-pandemic, right? Our unemployment rate is still almost double than what it was. So you would think that that is great for companies that are looking to hire. And our demand is above pre-pandemic levels, almost 20% higher than the pre-pandemic start. However, we're seeing companies have openings that are going unfilled. And that's only exercised even more if you've seen that NFIB index that it's at a 48-year high of job openings. 44% of SMB job openings are unfilled versus an average of 22% over the last 48 years. And it's
Did you say 40%? Did you say 40%?
44%. It is a 48-year high. It used to be 22% on average when unfilled. And this is during a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
It's honestly just unprecedented to see this kind of supply and demand mismatch. And when you look and you say, it's not demand. There's definitely supply. It's the workforce isn't reengaging. And that's driven by multiple things.
Let's talk about what those multiple things are, because the explanation that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce would give is that it's enhanced unemployment benefits.
Janet Yellen would say no.
Exactly. And that's so would Jerome Powell. He absolutely would say no. It's a mix of factors. What's your take, Irina?
It's definitely a mix of factors, and it's not one thing. So one, yes, unemployment benefits extended is helping because you're making more in many cases by being unemployed than going back into frontline working roles. However, also 70% of schools are in some form of hybrid system right now, where you're a little bit in school, a little bit not, a little remote, which is having big impact on parents and figuring out how to manage that. And then lastly, and this issue I am not seeing being talked about as much, and we talked about this pre-pandemic, But what's happened with COVID, it has materially accelerated technology and industry shift. If you think about how we all buy today, I mean, it's completely different than what it was a year and a half ago. And it's affected almost every single industry. And what it's done is it's expedited the skills gap that we saw that was going to be a problem in 15, 20 years. Well, it's a problem now. The workforce of tomorrow doesn't really exist today. And we're seeing, I'll give you some interesting stats that we saw that was really just highlighting this imbalance that's happening. And for example, a software developer. Today, for every software developer today, there's 24 open roles. For every waitress or server, there's 22 open roles. So 22 companies are vying for the same person. A nurse is at 53 right now. I mean, and we're seeing this across several different categories.
Does this have wage growth written all over it?
In certain pockets, yes. But, you know, the other side of that is it depends, because if you're starting to move more remote, one of the conversations we're having with a lot of our clients is, what salaries are you paying? Are you paying the salaries of that role where the company's headquartered, or where this remote worker is potentially living?
What are they doing?
So there's
what are they doing?
Movement. It's unclear. It depends on the demand. And so one of the things that we're seeing, it's actually shifting from a geography-based wage conversation to much more driven by demand. And so if you're looking at numbers, like it's 53 jobs for every potential nurse, it's going to start impacting what you're willing to pay a nurse in a certain area if you need them there.
So Janet Yellen did
remote or on site.
Well, you know, Irina, you did say it's multiple reasons. Janet Yellen said, and I'm looking for the quote that I wrote down, but I think she specifically said she doesn't think the unemployment benefits are impacting the employment picture. Doesn't think unemployment benefits are hurting hiring specifically. How much of it do you think is that?
Here's why I say it's a mix of it. When you look at the server waitress category, there's definitely an impact from unemployment that's impacting in some way. Because when we're looking at it, again, that 48-year high I mentioned with SMB, and majority of them are frontline COVID-impacted roles. We're looking at waitresses and servers where for every role there's 22 job openings for every person. So in many ways, it is impacting it. But then when you're looking a little bit more upper funnel, higher salary roles, it's not impacting the software developers as much. It's not impacting the nurse occupations as much. And so that's why it's underneath the surface, and it's getting masked with this overall picture of an employment number or a jobs number that's just not carrying the true story of what's happening.
Just so briefly here, when it comes to the servers and the waiters and waitresses you speak of, is part of it just saying, hey, I don't want to risk getting the virus. I don't feel comfortable being around people who are not wearing masks and being close to them, serving them food. How big of a part is that?
I just got about 30 seconds.
I mean, the vaccination rollout is definitely a part of it. When you look across the country, the states with higher vaccination rolled out have higher servers coming back to the workforce. And then when you look at it by a state-by-state basis, some of the unemployment benefits are anywhere from $12 to $19 an hour. And so depending on the state that you're in, you're making the decision based on that. But again, it's not only based on unemployment, because we're seeing this supply-demand imbalance happening in categories that really aren't as touched by these frontline COVID-impacted industries as much. We're seeing it happen in industries that have seen continued and pretty steady growth throughout COVID.
Well, if it continues, we'll start to see it maybe potentially impact productivity and GDP growth. Hey, Irina, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. Irina Novoselsky, she is CEO of Career Builder, joining us on the phone in New York City.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So there's another story in the magazine this week. Tim and I were talking about it among ourselves earlier this week. Of course, the new issue is out. It's about how Facebook already, Tim, we know, has lots of adults, and now they're going after our kids.
Yeah, they are. I was thinking about this, too, how big of a deal it was that Facebook bought Instagram for $1 billion, considering how big of a part of its business it has become. Fortunately, we have Kurt Wagner joining us, technology reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone from San Francisco. Kurt, I'm wondering about the strategy here when it comes to Facebook for kids, and that Instagram for kids, excuse me. The thing that I think about is gateway drug.
sort of, yeah. I think there's a two-part strategy, right? I think there's the here Facebook is doing the world a favor in their minds, which is they say, hey, listen, a lot of preteens are already using social media. They're using it without any parental oversight. They're lying about their age, right, to create an Instagram account. And we're creating this app that's going to solve that problem, right? It's going to give them that kind of social media experience, but it's going to do it in a safe way, and kids are going to like that, and parents are going to like that. Now, the other reason they're doing this, of course, is that this is a great opportunity for them to get 10, 11, 12-year-olds using their app before they can then graduate to the app where they show them all the ads and, you know, hopefully they buy things with shopping and all that stuff. So there's definitely a benefit to Facebook doing this. But they, of course, would also like you to know that they're trying to solve a problem that already exists, which is that kids are already using Instagram.
Yeah. Critics, what are they saying about this move?
Well, there's a lot of critics, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And I think the two main arguments, which I think are both very valid, is one, you know, what is this going to do to a preteen's mental health, right? If you're 10 years old and suddenly, you know, you're caring about how much people like your photo or what someone commented on your photo, or you know, you're looking and you're comparing yourself to celebrities or whoever you may be following. You have to imagine that has some mental health impact on someone who's that young. And I think that's a real concern. Now, the second part is around data and privacy. What exactly is Facebook going to collect from your 10-year-old who has this app? And are they going to keep it safe, right? We've seen Facebook have tons of data security issues. There's been leaks. There have been there's instances where they simply let the data walk right out the front door. And so do you want your 10-year-old's, you know, name, email address, whatever it may be, on a server at Facebook headquarters? Is that going to be a safe thing for them to do? And there's a lot of people who say absolutely not.
I guess what I would want to do is poll Mark Zuckerberg and other senior executives at Facebook and say, so are your kids going to be on Instagram, tween or teen or whatever you call it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a totally valid question. Zuckerberg has said he has two daughters. I think the oldest is 5. Mm-hmm. I think he said that his daughter uses their Messenger Kids app to kind of like talk with her cousins, right? Like maybe she'll do a video chat with grandma or whatever. But, you know, Instagram's a totally different beast, right? I don't think there's a lot of people who think a 5-year-old should be on Instagram. I don't think he'd probably put his 5-year-old on Instagram, but you know, the way they're thinking about this is Messenger Kids is kind of relevant to 6, 7, 8-year-olds, right, as they're starting to video chat with grandma and grandpa. And then once they get to 8 years old, they want to graduate to something that feels a little bit cooler, and that's where this Instagram Youth is what they're calling it. Instagram Youth would come in.
Yeah.
Where does TikTok come into all of this, Kurt? And to what extent is this a reaction, if at all, to TikTok? We know about Instagram Reels. It's Facebook's attempt at what TikTok does. But is that part of the strategy here?
I don't know if that's the motivation. I mean, Messenger Kids has been around for about 4 years, a little less, but so clearly Facebook was thinking about this before TikTok became a real threat to them. But at the same time, if you think about, you know, you have your 10-year-old and you're a parent and you say, okay, well, they want to use social media and there's a safe, quote unquote, safe Instagram, or there's this unsafe TikTok, like, hey, maybe the parent's going to say, sure, you can put Instagram Youth on your iPad, right? And suddenly that's the first experience the 10-year-old has. And so when they become 13, they stick with Instagram instead of TikTok. Now, most kids, as you know, use everything, right? So doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, they're not going to use TikTok, but right. it could certainly be a way for Facebook to get its products in the hands of these kids much earlier than it would otherwise be allowed.
Hey, Kurt, just one last question. A reminder, though, of how important Instagram is to the Facebook story, and if they can grab kids now, this is maybe, you know, revenue drivers, you know, for years to come.
Absolutely. I mean, they've said they don't want to put ads in this app. They're not going to show ads to kids under 13. But, you know, the hope is that they love this product and then they use the main app, and that's where they do show ads. And so Instagram has been a huge, huge, huge part of Facebook's growth, both for users but also for its business. It's hard to really overstate how important Instagram is to them. So, you know, this is a chance to on-ramp kids onto, you know, what is becoming their most valuable product. And so you can see why they want to do that.
I believe Tim called it the gateway drug.
Yeah, I did. And you look, I think Instagram really is like, it's going to go down as the greatest acquisition in the history. Well, I mean, definitely of the last decade, but maybe in the history of Silicon Valley. Like, it's so, Facebook would be lost without it.
And it makes me think of our conversation with Scott Galloway about kind of breaking up some of the big tech and unleashing some value within some of these names. Kurt Wagner, that story in the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine on newsstands, online, and on the Bloomberg. Kurt Wagner is tech reporter at Bloomberg News.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Yes, indeed, it is time for the Drive to the Close. And Charlie, of course, breaking down the trade on this Jobs Friday. And quite a day, and certainly some optimism. Risk trade on. There is, I guess, some calmness to some extent about those inflation concerns and the reflation trade to some extent. But you are seeing pretty much the Dow and the S&P at its highs of the day. The NASDAQ a little bit lower, but it's up the most on a percentage basis, Tim, up about 0.9%. So tech really providing support for today. Trade.
Yeah, let's get right to it with David Dietz, Managing Principal and Senior Portfolio Strategist at PPAC Private Wealth Management. He joins us on the phone from Summit, New Jersey. He has $8 billion under management at PPAC Private Wealth Management. Dave Dietz, what a surprise jobs report this morning. How does that change your outlook for how the economy looks in 2021?
Well, you know, we are not really making any wholesale changes in the portfolio, I think, for a couple reasons. You know, the first one is I think the diminished job creation is due to really short-term temporary factors. I look at three things that may have played a role. One is, you know, lack of childcare. People would like to get back to work, but they still don't have, you know, the daycare and the schools and so forth that can take care of their kids. Obviously, it's a controversial issue, but certainly having this governmental financial assistance for the jobless and so forth can't help in terms of incentivizing getting back to work, but that should end by September 1. And then, of course, I think there's still people we know are fearful that they're more likely to get the COVID if they get back outside into the workforce. So some of those are short-term factors. Of course, we can't make too much of these, Tim, because the numbers of jobs that were created this month were still less than February and March when those factors were still in play.
Mm-hmm. Hey, David, how does this coincide with what we've been hearing from CEOs about the labor market and the outlook?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a frustrating thing because the CEOs are saying, gee, we've got the work, we just can't find the workers. And here, of course, we didn't see the job creation we wanted that you think you would have had given this demand from corporate America. But that, again, plays into those three theories as to why people are not responding to the demand for workers because of these existential factors, including the child care and getting sick if you get back out there.
Yeah, it's just there is this disconnect, I still feel like, between what we heard from companies and the earnings. Like, it's not just, you know, Chipotle CEO, who we spoke to a few weeks ago. It was Uber saying that they are taking a significant hit because of incentives that they're going to have to pay to drivers. It's just, I'm having trouble making sense of it.
Well, I mean, that's a good point. Of course, I think Uber and some of the other gig worker companies have some special issues there because there's certainly a force to try and make them have their gig workers
right.
become regular employees and so forth. But, you know, having said that, we did see, Tim, we saw more hours worked in April. We saw higher pay, more money being made. So perhaps there's a sense that companies are trying to be very, very efficient here. They've got the work. They're trying to just push harder the people that they have going right now. And, of course, the other thing to keep in mind is although that unemployment rate ticked up, it wasn't because there were job losses, but rather more people came into the workforce, got off the sidelines, and are raising their hands for a job. And I think that's a good sign. People don't do that if they think there's no opportunity whatsoever out there.
David, portfolios, it's all, you know, very custom in what people's, you know, long-term goals are or what their kind of plans are for either retirement or major, you know, moves in their personal lives. I get that. But more broadly, are there things that you are thinking about or the conversations you're having with clients when it comes to portfolio management at this time?
Yeah, I think there's two main themes. One is it too late? I mean, here we are, you know, the Dow is at another record high today. I think it's their 24th this year. And of course, valuations are at the upper edges of what's normal. But the fact of the matter is, you know, what else are you going to do? I talk with people about, well, you know, where are you going to be 10 years from now? You're going to get 1.55 each year on the 10-year treasury, or you're going to have, you know, a 4% earnings yield on the S&P 500, which traditionally has grown. I think 10 years from now, you'll have a lot more money in the market, so you still want to tilt in that direction. But we all know at some point the Fed is going to have to taper here, and of course there's going to be taper tantrums. The other main theme here is you always have to be looking forward. You can't look in the rearview mirror. What worked the last few years was the secular tech trade. It's great, but it doesn't have the tailwinds behind it the way other sectors of the economy that should take advantage of a rapidly expanding economy with this wall of stimulus cash coming out with these very low interest rates. So we still think that you should have major positions, perhaps a tilt into the financials, which benefit from higher interest rates, materials, energy, which can benefit from an onset of inflation, and of course, travel and leisure as people reengage and get out of the home and enjoy traveling again.
Well, let's talk about some of your picks, because I can't believe that I've gone an entire show today without talking about chips. Intel is one of the companies.
Day ain't over yet.
Yeah, day ain't over, exactly. But it's been such a topic, not just this week, but over the last few months.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a KISS stock. We know there's a chip shortage. What is the grandfather of all chip companies? It's Intel.
Well, that could be the problem, though, right? That it is the grandfather of all chip companies.
Well, it's the grandfather, but, you know, I think that what I really like is the management change there. Hmm. And you've got Pat, is it Grissinger?
Gelsinger.
Gelsinger coming in, and what I like about him, he's kind of like a Steve Jobs type. He's not a financial engineer. He is a real engineer, and I think that's what Intel needs to take their vast resources and reassert their number one positions in things like autonomous driving, in things like artificial intelligence. I think the opportunities are there, and of course they are building some more capabilities in the United States. Unfortunately, I think geopolitical tensions are on the rise. You're going to be better off having your facilities here. And of course, valuations do matter, Tim. And you've got a stock that's trading at a discount to the S&P 500. You've got a dividend close to 2.5%, a full 1% more than the 10-year treasury, more than 1% than the S&P 500. So it reminds me, you know, of almost Microsoft a decade ago when it was actually a dog of the Dow, and then he brought in new leadership and off it went. So I like Intel going forward here.
Well, it's also to some extent, and Tim and I were talking about this earlier in the week, David, that just like in the airline industry, you have essentially two major manufacturers, Airbus and Boeing. In the chip sector, we used to have a lot more players, but it's really coming down to Intel in the United States in a big way.
Well, they've got some stiff competition with
AMD
and AMD, but still, given the shortage, there's plenty of room at the table for everyone, and so that's why I think Intel on, you know, a risk-reward basis really looks good going forward to play the tech and also play the reopening and the economy.
Well, why Intel over AMD then?
So, you know, I think that you know, the interesting thing about investing is you're also looking at what's the handicap on each horse.
Okay.
And here, people have kind of given up Intel for dead. I like that valuation, and I like the new management that can refresh the approach.
Okay, just in 30 seconds, talk about Boeing.
You know, hey, it's got to be one of the quintessential plays for the reopening of the economy. What do we all want to do? We want to do that trip that we didn't do at Thanksgiving, that we didn't do last summer. In many cases, it's going to involve getting on an airplane. And it's not just the United States. It's worldwide. And so these airlines, although they can be fragile, there's only two places where they can replenish the fleet. That's Airbus. That's Boeing. And we know from what happened with the 737 MAX, no airline company wants to put all their chips in any one manufacturer. There's going to be plenty of business for Boeing. They've
right.
got a backlog that most companies would drool over. And of course, it was over 400.
Got it.
Now it's got a 2 in front of it.
All right, David. Have a good weekend. David Dietz over at PPAC Private Wealth Management.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.